Hi, this is Robert Shear with another edition of Shear Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guest, and in this case, at least from the pen of my guest. I don't know about the brain. He's known as Mr. Fish. Your Christian name was Dwayne Booth. And I have to say, all jokes aside, I think this is one of the great graphic artists we have, and what's left of cartooning, and certainly political editorial cartooning. There's no one in the country who touches him. And Mr. Fish, and he looks grim now and everything. This is going to be fun, Fishy. I'm not one of your targets in your cartoon, although I am here to celebrate a book in which I do appear, and it's called Nobody Left. And, I hope it's available if you ever find a bookstore. I guess you can get it. Can you get this on Amazon?
Oh, yeah.
A terrible thing, words to say, but okay. Conversations with famous radicals, progressives, and cultural icons about the end of dissent, revolution, and liberalism in America. And these famous radicals and so forth, I happen to be one of them. It's kind of a joke, but there are some seriously famous people: Norman Mailer, Christopher Hitchens, Howard Zinn, Lily Tomlin, Graham Nash, Joan Baez, Dennis Kucinich, Tariq Ali, Calvin Trillin, Mort Sahl, and Paul Krasner, John Stewart, and others. And I love this book, not only because it supplies me with my indispensable obit in what Mr. Fish in his grim fashion has written about me. He already describes me as a relic, so I might as well recycle it with my wife's permission, and it can be my obit. But really, what it's great is for, I think, is an introduction to your writing. And you remind me of some of my more brilliant students I have at the University of Southern California, where I've been for over 20 years. Some of them just don't do well in school, but they're brilliant. And it was really a great surprise for me. I always knew you were a brilliant artist. I knew your work from the LA Weekly, from the LA Times, from Harper's. I forget all the lists. What else do we have to mention? Right? Where have you been? You've been everywhere. So yeah. Let's drop that. And I'm trying to do a quick introduction here. Lots of luck, Bob. But what really impressed me about you, and particularly with this book, but I've seen it before, because sometimes you write too much in your cartoons. You shove a lot in. But you actually are a terrific writer, and of great depth, actually. And one would think, wow, this guy probably went to the best prep school. It's kind of like our mutual friend Chris Hedges, you know, all the way up through Harvard Divinity School, a very erudite and so forth. But you throw around these great philosophical thinkers and these great concepts with abandon. And yet when I read about you in this book, and I find you actually the most interesting person in this book, let me be honest about it. You're this kid who couldn't even manage to get to class at Rutgers, get off the bus and show up. You know, you're the kid I'm always complaining about. Where's your paper? You know, I want to work with you here, but you got to give me something to work with. You know, you're that guy, right? Were you a dropout in college? You were not very successful, right?
Not academically, no. Yeah, I did drop out of Rutgers.
By the way, let me interrupt. I should mention, you are now a lecturer at the Ivy League University, right, of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you've been honored by the other Annenberg School, where you are in Pennsylvania, at USC. And they had a whole exhibit, and they published one of your books. So you've gained academic respectability, young man. But you were really a horrible screw-up in college. So just let's begin with that, because a lot of people listening to this might have had some similar experience, or at least it'll make them more tolerant of their offsprings when they don't do well.
Yeah, sure. It is true that academically and in the classroom structure, I did not thrive. That said, I thrived in the atmosphere of the university, because I did drop out in the middle of my sophomore year, only because I found it distracting to go to class. And I didn't like being the structure of learning. And I became very impatient and wanted to figure out things on my own. So I actually lived on campus for the next 3 years, just on the floors of friends and really roughing it, having people pay for all of my food and it was lovely. It was a really lovely time. And I had access to a really great library and access to New York City. So with
the how old are you? What years were those when you were in college?
These are the 1980s.
So what are you now? You're getting to be old. You're what, 50 years old or something?
I'm in my 50s now, yes.
Oh, my God. Look at they grow up, don't they?
They do grow up.
Well, let's jump to that right away. One of the great things about your book, you know, I don't know if people remember Graham Nash from, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash and all the people you got. You really bring out great stuff about these people. And you let them talk. And you really learn from all of them. It's a wonderful introduction to people. And you enjoy their differences and their complexity. And so just why don't you take us through the book? Because we'll run out of time and I'll forget to mention the book or deal with it. So let's deal with the book right off the top here.
Okay.
Who are all these people? And you really are paying homage to a bygone era. The book is called Nobody Left, but what he really means is it all dried up and died for him about 20 years ago, and then he had to keep drawing and making cartoons about these less interesting people and a more inadequate counterculture. But it's really the culture, counterculture of the 60s and 70s that you really, that shaped you and ruined you for life, really, didn't it?
It's true. One of the key things that I guess that we should talk about is how did this counterculture come to being? And for me, it was really the first time there was a really seismic shift in who was allowed to frame the debate around politics, around culture, and literally around the meaning of life. And that's when artists and philosophers and cultural critics were allowed into the debate or forced them their way into the debate. And actually talked about what the meaning of life was from an emotional point of view. Because really, when it comes down to it, I think that if we're going to be honest with ourselves, do we really want to learn what morality is from institutionalized structures from politics and from religion? No. I mean, look at those institutions. Do they exercise morality in a way that we all should be proud of? Absolutely not. I think that historically speaking, it was artists and writers who engage with that question, what does life feel like? What is the emotional component of life? That's when you can speak honestly with your friends and with your loved ones openly. And that's the voice of artists over the many thousands of years that artists have been communicating this kind of topic. So all of a sudden, after the Second World War, when it was demonstrated that bureaucracy and people in charge maybe didn't have our best interests at heart, they nearly ended the species. There was this search to find what does it all mean? You know, how do we engage with this in a way that is?
Yeah, but right now you're making it all sound highfalutin and complex. Take us to the bus. You're on the bus and you don't get off the bus and go to your class at Rutgers where they're trying to teach you creative writing because you're listening to Bob Dylan or somebody. So, you've got these earphones on all the time.
I do.
And you're one of those people the teachers seem to think they can never reach because you're just out to lunch somewhere, but you're learning, right?
I'm learning. And as I said, I mean, I'm engaging in really serious things. I mean, it might sound highfalutin the way I'm talking about it, but to me, it is some of the subjects when it comes to asking questions about who we are, why we are here. Those can get murky, you know, because they involve a lot of self-examination that recognizes that we're not reliably benign. We're not saintly all of the time. We're all of these things. So art actually engages with all of those things in a very serious and interesting way that says that it's okay to be faulty and it's okay to be unreliable in many ways. I mean, we can even go back if we want to even look at what shapes us as human beings. Yes, I could talk about art. I can talk about where you go to recharge yourselves after a busy day, devoting time to either your job or to school. You unwind with art. Right, with these voices, but you also do that with friends and family. And I can tell you a quick story about what informed my character very early on. It was I always go to my mother when I think about
it. Did you say what deformed your character or formed? I missed the word.
Deformed?
Yes. Formed. Oh, okay. Yes.
You can be the judge of whether it's a deformation. But I remember my mother was somebody, and everybody in my family was very curious about just, let's figure out what the greatest punchline is to this moment. Let's not figure out, you know, how to be, follow the rules and to be proper. How do we punch holes in decorum? And so as an example, from my earliest memories of, as a child, starting in kindergarten, all the way up through 12th grade, my mother composed the same exact sick note for me every single time I was sick. And she thought it was hilarious. And I'll tell you what it was. She wrote, even if I was vacation, I was not sick very much, but sometimes I would miss school. But her note every single time said, Dwayne was absent from school yesterday because he had diarrhea. Yes. And she did it every, and it was the only note that she would write for me. I would go.
It's one that leaves the teacher grateful that you stayed home.
Right. But there was no way around it. I mean, and so it taught me that the camaraderie of family and friends was at least as important as these bureaucratic larger structures in society, and in many cases much more important, because they taught me to be self-effacing. They taught me not to take things so seriously. And when you don't take things seriously, you develop this muscle of questioning the legitimacy of things. You know, what are these filters that we hold on to as we move through society that society says that we shouldn't question? You know, what is the hierarchy protecting? So with this reflex built into me from a very early age, I was always looking for what was an alternative way to look at a particular truth, just in pursuit of a meaningful punchline. And I think that jokes and humor do that. They upend these structures in a way that you can see their construction. You can see the mechanics of things a lot easier when you do that.
Yeah, but the last thing your mother wanted for you is to become some outrageous political cartoonist. And your stepfather didn't feel that way. You've written about that. And you're kind of in their eyes, the kindest thing one could say is that they don't understand you. But they probably think you're a great failure, or thought of you as a great failure, right?
They don't. I would say that they understand me, but they don't. They never would predict that it would be a way for me to sustain myself in any meaningful way.
So that you could actually, you know, make a career out of it. Then that would be okay. So let's cut to the chase here. What was the appeal? You know, we may have been spoiled in the. I'm older than you, so I remember the 50s, and you know, that was a horror. And so I understand the appeal of the 60s and 70s. What I didn't appreciate is how unusual those two decades were, you know, and that they weren't going to be repeated. They were an accident of capitalism, an accident of history, the emergence of a world culture, so it mattered what some people called Beatles were saying in London, or, you know, what some Russian poet was saying in the old Soviet Union, or what have you. And these are the people you talk to. Some were like Norman Mailer, veterans of World War II. You know, Graham Nash was part of this whole cultural explosion. Paul Krasner was one of the great chroniclers. So before we waste too much time on your story and my story, what did you really learn from all these people? I mean, they clearly inspired you. And you know, you're doing great work now, but there's a bit of nostalgia. Why isn't it like it was or I expected it to be? I suspect you're not alone in feeling that way. So take us there. Why aren't you? I mean, isn't Biden sort of what you imagine? Come on, I don't want to set you up too much, but what is the point of this book, really? Because I love reading it because it's, you know, I'm learning about some of these people I knew quite well that you write, and I learn about them. So I'm recommending the book very highly. And your, as I say, your introductions to them, which are even more, almost as long-winded as my introductions on this show, nonetheless are interesting, more interesting than mine. So really, I want people to look at this book, you know, and it's you've got a lot of cartoons in it, you mm-hmm. know, and so and they're alone worth the price of admission. But it's really the writing. The writing in this book is really quite powerful. And I, you know, people, they buy books, but they don't read them as much. I don't want to be mean
That's
about it.
Pictures in
but,
mind, yeah.
but I'm finding that all the time. People tell me, oh, yeah, I saw that book or I heard about it or I listened to it. But it doesn't seem to have the same impact. And I mostly do this show because it forces me to read books mm-hmm. that I otherwise might skim, including yours. And reading yours, I just was blown away. And this is the third, fourth time. You know, admittedly, I only at first thought I would just read about myself. But I was drawn in by your introductions. And it's great. So introduce us to the book, please, before we run out of time.
Yes. Well, it's not an accident that they're interviews. And what I mean by that is one of the things that also thrilled me growing up, other than the actual art that I was exposed to, whether we're talking about jazz or radical forms of new journalism, Hunter S. Thompson, and writers like that who were attempting to engage with what we were talking about as politics and culture in a way that was much more what is the personal perspective without filters. I found that very, very thrilling. But what I also was very interested in discovering all my life are interviews with these artists. Because through interview, I found what the process was. How do you become a radical? How do you become somebody who sees virtue, bravery, and joy in essentially being an outlaw? Because there are plenty of indication inside society that you do not want to take that path. A, it doesn't pay very well. B, there are great penalties to your creature comforts. You know, just as we were talking about, the idea that I would attempt to be able to have a family, pay for food and a roof over my head by drawing cartoons that basically say, F you to how the society is set up and capitalism is dangerous and it has to be dismantled. But how do I get money to survive? You know,
Well, you have one great cartoon that I have in my hallway here. I don't know if you have it, Andy, where you're painting some rich guy and you don't get through the bad A word, and yet it's of him, and then you want him to give you money to finish the painting in which he's described as an asshole. That's sort of your that's the contradiction of your career choice.
Yeah, but it's really the only choice that one has, and this is in how society is set up, and that's why I thought it would be really interesting to talk to people who have had to navigate that trajectory for themselves. You know, how do you commodify activism, radicalism? And it's always very curious to me. So you do that with humor, you do that with igniting people's passions and appetites for truth telling, because people are really interested and curious about that, and they want to do it themselves. And so by demonstrating that it can be done, and it can be done in a way that is edifying of the human experience, quite literally. I mean, these are things that when I engage with this work, it's because every fiber of my being wants to have an actual meaningful life. I mean, it might sound corny, but I feel like there's not a lot of time that we all have as people on the planet. And so I want to have as much integrity and joy as is possible.
So you know, it's a wild statement you just made. You added, we don't have much time, and then you added, as people on this planet. Now, I grew up thinking, well, we don't have much time because we're mortal, and it's going to end, and you ought to have a good life. I never thought, and I think your comment is accurate, I never thought at the end of my stay here, I'm going to turn 85 in a week or two, I never thought there would be an addendum to that. You're not talking about the individual. You're talking about the world's population.
Right.
And you just threw it in. But it doesn't sound like crazy talk. It sounds very plausible. You know, going through a pandemic, we've seen what one major medical crisis can do. God knows if we have 100 of them unleashed on us by one cause or another. Mm-hmm. And yet we're, you know, yeah, we make a lot of noise about it, but not doing very much about it. And so please, please introduce us to some of these people you interviewed. Leave me out of it. And what were the memorable ones? What are the essays you'd really recommend right off the bat that people read in this?
Well, one of the ones that I really, really love, and I love many of them, but one of the ones that I return to every once in a while because I think it was really, really interesting and precise is the one that I did with Mort Saul. And those people who don't know who Mort Saul was, he was considered the inventor.
You say, is he no longer with us, Mort Saul?
He's still around.
Oh.
He
became convinced late in life that I was a CIA agent, but we don't have to go there. Go ahead.
he is somebody who is the inventor of what I call stand-up commentary. He made it okay to name names in the government when you're creating your satire and you're criticizing power. And then that led to Lenny Bruce, for sure, but... Remember that Mort Saul was very, very smart and one of the most radical thinkers consistently up into this interview that I did with him was in the mid-2000s, I think. And he was still one of the most radical people that I ever engaged with and very, very keen on exposing the lie that there are two parties that are separate in this country. That there is even a modicum of caring that comes from elite society. All of those things that we really need to recognize, because there's lots of distractions that people think that the dominant culture has us in its best interest. And one of the things that was really important to me with this book was I'm engaging with the majority of the people that I talk to. Lived in the world prior to the many technologies that are distracting now. And this is when I probably am going to sound like an old person. But there are distractions that come from our technologies that are preventing us from knowing that it's time to panic, knowing that we should be worried about the environment and the fact that we are less and less engaging with each other in person. In intimate ways. Sure, we can say that we have millions of friends and we interact with social media, but it is it's a short form and it's a very glib kind of sloganeering with which we engage with each other. And that's really, really dangerous because when it comes to the issues of trying to figure out how our politics should actually protect us, that's a longer conversation. That's a deeper conversation that we should have. So we have to figure out, and many of the people that I talked to seemed to agree with me. How do we re-engage with each other in a way that we have stamina for, quite literally? Because I think that being able to have longer conversations and sitting with each other's company and probing these deep questions that have been with us since the beginning of time, we need less cacophony around us to pull us from these deep conversations. In fact, if you will allow me, there is a quote from Norman Mailer, since you mentioned him earlier, that serves exactly what we're talking about right now, that question of what is technology doing to the human experience. And he was writing about television. This is from the 1950s, but I think that it really applies to modern technologies. And so he said, television perpetuates the notion that one can learn the secrets of the universe in some easy way. It teaches us that boredom is better than dread. And so it's those kinds of insights that...
Boredom is better than dread.
Yes, boredom is better than dread. And that's a great insight to exactly what we're experiencing now. And it even extends to, all through the book too, is I constantly go back to my love of jazz. As a form that was a political kind of activism in and of itself, what it did for the legitimizing the search and the adventurism of the Black community in an emotional and intellectual way, that was very, very important. But also, when you listen to jazz, there's no words, there's no lyrics that you are responding to. what you have to do with that music, you have to populate that music with your own feelings and your own life experience. Think about how, what kind of art we have today with the commodification of all art. We don't have art that is asking us to participate in that way. And I think that what's key to the survival of all of us is figuring out how to increase participation in all of our interactions. And I think art is a really important tool that is slowly being disintegrated by our modern technologies. And it's something that this book is attempting to revive and insist that we pay attention with some great demonstrations with good conversation and art.
You know, it's interesting because I also, you know, jazz changed my life in a very basic way. I would go from the Bronx down to Greenwich Fields and hear Charlie Mingus and, you know, Thelonious Monk and so forth. And then when I came out to Berkeley, that was the whole deal. But what was always impressive to me about jazz is that was an exercise in spontaneity to a much greater degree than any other art form. The textbooks I were reading had all been carefully edited and vetted and pruned out, but even classical music and whatever, you know, was all controlled. Somebody had looked at it, somebody had checked it out, and so forth. Jazz was happening in that club that night. Maybe somebody recorded it. It would never come out the same way again, and somebody was taking risks.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about risks, because it's interesting. If I were your parent, and you do say something, by the way, you wrote in this book that you gave me, you said, the father I never had, this is to me, and the bearded mother I always wanted, onward. Well, I guess I'm your bearded mother. But it's interesting because, you know, you actually picked a career that was going to be problematic no matter what. And you decided to do it in a very principled and radical way. But we did have other people, Paul Conrad, for instance, legendary, four times Pulitzer Prize winner at the LA Times, was, to my money, just as nervy as you are, maybe not as, culturally, a good Catholic boy to the end, but still, you know, and there are plenty of others, but you really pushed the envelope and it was being rewarded. You were, but what happened is the ground was pulled from under you. Political cartooning, and this was the subject of your really important exhibit at the University of Southern California, Annenberg School, and you've repeated it, I think, at Penn, right? University of Pennsylvania, is that political cartooning is dead. And political cartooning really was the original mass art. It was a drawing on a cave wall. You could say that guy sucks, or the king is full of it, and you could do it in a very primitive form. So you actually made this career work for you. You were honored. You've won many awards from press clubs, and you know, I think you've won two from Sigma Delta Chi, the National Cartooning Award. You know, that's a really big deal, and yet your profession ended. Political cartooning doesn't exist now. So it's a good thing that you can write, because, on SheerPost, website I publish, we run all your stuff. And people, by the way, want to see a great documentary that they have access on the website. You're not promoting yourself at all, Mr. Fish, but as Mr. Fish is the trade name. But really, you discuss a very important thing. We've lost the most immediate means of mass communication, the political cartoon. And doesn't really exist now.
It doesn't. And I think that one of the things that people should recognize is that it is lost, yes, but not because it's not effective or it's become this antiquated form of communication. There is overwhelming evidence that it is lost because it is so effective, because it does force conversations. And it does invite common citizens into the debate in a way that longer form, even journalism, just doesn't. That's the reason why there are fewer known cartoonists. I mean, they're still out there because as a form of art, it predates the invention of newspapers and magazines, to your point, cave
paintings. Oh, you didn't have to be literate. It was just somebody, could
right, have, you have to read,
scrawled
yeah.
on a wall or something, but it could communicate. Well, I mean, there are some cave drawings that are the form of original cartoons. And the American yeah. Revolution, you had, in the French Revolution and so forth, cartooning yeah. was probably right. the main form of communication, mass art. And it's gone right. now. Yeah, you're suggesting that it's gone because it's an inconvenient truth.
Exactly. Yeah, because if you look at it, when it comes to the visual form of communication, whether it's political cartooning or just fine art, it is universal. And a way that I process it and I think about it is that we use words to describe what the world means. Images show us what the world would say to us in self-defining itself. So that's why it's universal. It looks like reality. It implicates us all into the moment. You mentioning the spontaneity inside jazz is very key to when it comes to art, because art demands that you exist in the moment. It brings you to a moment. And when you're sitting in that moment,
you're cartooning art.
Cartooning art and just visual art. When yeah. you look at art, when you're engaging with music and with visual art, you're being asked to ignore what you typically use to make sense of the world, right? It's asking you to open up both your heart and your head to how you're going to decipher what is in front of you, whether it's music.
So let's take your head and getting back to your book. Which of these people opened you up and that you... Graham Nash is an interesting person. Paul Krasner, you want to talk about a few of them?
Yeah, I will tell you, definitely. For different reasons, they're all in there because they opened me up in some way. But talking about somebody like Graham Nash, let me just say, because it's just talking about music, and you asking who opened my mind up more than anybody is the one person that I could not get in the book, who's John Lennon. John Lennon absolutely changed my life. And to this, every single day, I'm sad that he's not here. Literally every single day, it crosses my mind and it really bums me out. And that's why I was mentioning interviews earlier in our discussion, because one of the things that changed me in addition to John Lennon's music was I collected bootleg recordings of all the interviews that he did when I was like 13 up until now. And it was those kinds of conversations that made me really want to be an artist. The same thing with Paul Krasner. Remember, one of the things that made Paul Krasner really special is...
Who had the Realist magazine. And,
yes, and who is credited as being the father of the underground press. He had his interviews that he did were an impolite interview with and then the subject. His form of interviewing to me was just blew my mind. It was amazing what he could get to. And I wanted to emulate that. And it's one of the first things I told him when I saw him. I'm like, you're the reason why I'm sitting in front of you, because I want to sound like you when I interview you. And he gave me his little tricks on what to do when you're interviewing somebody. And some of them are just creating spaces of discomfort that your subject will want to fill because they don't like discomfort. And inside that discomfort, they may reveal something about themselves. Was one of the little gems that he taught me about. But what Graham Nash and Krasner and Lily Tomlin, the way these people engage with questions is different from politicians or people who are studied in a different way. They do bring themselves to the question. I really don't know how to talk about it. It's something that that maybe everybody already recognizes why you go to art, because they're bringing something truthful about themselves and they're really listening to the questions.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest. You say this, by the way, but I go to a lot of art galleries and museums. I find a lot of it to be just the opposite. It seems to be done for commercial reasons. There's a market in that kind of art. It catches on. A lot of the same people who are destroying the rest of our economy invest in art. Mm-hmm. But what goes in these museums now has got to have appeal to people who run hedge funds and big corporations, right?
Yeah.
And so let's not hold up art as a center of integrity or generally.
Let me make a clarification with that, because you're right about how the gallery has been turned into a store. That's been going on for a while. And there are people who are investing in the artifacts that are created and buying and trading them, like baseball cards, you know, but on the $1 billion level. Yes, that's existing. But it's really important to recognize, when it comes to talking about art and artists, it's a way to think, much more to me, rather than the proof of the artifact, right? So if I would love to go with you to some of these museums, and I know exactly what you're talking about, but some of these things that are being drowned out by this commodification that does overwhelm the viewing, because when you're in a museum, there's security guards with the guns. It feels also like a church. You know, it's turned into an atmosphere that is not really conducive to engaging really openly and seriously and emotionally with some of these things, unfortunately. But they do exist. And I would challenge you to think about these things outside of the museum and see if there are some useful insights that remind you that you are a living, breathing human being that should have empathy for not only yourself, but other people around you. That's what it's there for. It's there to leak into your contemplation of your journey.
Okay. Now, you know, far be for me, but since I am your, what'd you say, your bearded mother, we got to push the book here. And no, really, I think the world of this book. I really do. And, you know, talk about what, you know, it's a bedtime reader. Who might they turn to this evening when they go to bed and they're not quite ready to go to sleep? They want to read an essay. That's the way I see it. That's the way I use it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So who could they turn to? Just pick out different people and tell us what you think is there.
I think that's going to be determined by your taste and your level of.
Right. You don't want to sell books. Go ahead.
I don't want to sell. I mean, it's full pictures.
Come on. You know, okay, let's go through who's in this book and why they're interesting, for God's sake. You know, seriously. Come on, bitch.
Like I said, I don't know who knows.
What was it about Norman Mailer now? I mean, oh, come on. Many people don't even know any longer who Norman Mailer was. Why is Howard Zinn in this book? Why Tariq Ali, a very interesting guy, Calvin Trillin? You know, what happened? Were these people you were able to get to, or these are people that inspired you?
It was both. I had a long list of people who inspired me, and as I started the process of writing the book, they kept dying off, so I had to keep putting a line through their names,
yeah.
Which was, you know, sent a certain amount of worry through me, because I really wanted to finish the book. But to your point, there's a lot of people who aren't going to know who some of these people are. And one of the missions of the book is to demonstrate that they are people who you need to know. I mean, they're telling the truth, and they're being really interesting, and their body of work is significant in so many ways. So it's my mission to educate, you know, readers as to who these people are, and to draw them in with some snarky, inappropriate drawing that is all through the book as well.
So let me, all right, so I said I wouldn't bring myself into it, but I will. You have, I'm in the book, and a good friend of mine, Christopher Hitchens, is in the book. And yet, in the essay you have on me, I'm debating Christopher Hitchens, and I'm being quite tough about it, and he was quite tough about me. And as I say, we ended up agreeing to disagree about the Iraq War, but we certainly never accepted each other's point of view. Mm-hmm. What was your point about Christopher Hitchens? What did he do for you?
What he did for me was that he made conversations, he deepened them. He deepened conversations for me. I was right there with you. And that was one of the things, as far as the Iraq War goes. Because as much as I found his line of reasoning reprehensible, there was no doubt and no debate about how well he communicated his ideas, and how joyful he was in debate, and also drawing on he loved to quote literature to back up his point. All of those things, philosophy, science. So he was such a he was just a very well-rounded guy who was really interesting to talk to, and that's really why I wanted to talk to him. Yeah.
So talk a little bit about John Lennon, because I have the same feeling you do, and but my interest is much more narrow than yours. I just love Working Class Hero, and I love that whole album, and I love stuff actually he did after the Beatles. And I thought there was an honesty and a rejection of commercial capitalist success, a really profound rejection there that is worth that I go to, you know, for clarity. I've written quite often. I know you write with music in the background. I've written quite often with John Lennon in the background, you know, those albums. But describe, because I think you said he was the pivotal figure in your education.
Yeah, it was just very grand. It's just very grounding to have somebody who is communicating in a way that just sounds so honest and in many ways painful, you know, and it's frustrating.
A working class hero is something to be. They feed you on drugs and TV and yeah.
It changed my life. The F word was in that song. To have a Beatle release a song where the language, he trusts his audience to get what he's trying to communicate. And that to me was one of the things that made him really interesting.
Let's talk about that word, because you know, I don't want to use it, because then you maybe some NPR station will carry this actually as a broadcast and not only as a podcast, and that they'd have to bleep it out or something. But these words matter a lot to you, and you throw them in all the time. You have a kind of a scatological imagination, and you also have played one cartoon you did that got me in trouble as a teacher. You had every one of these words we're not supposed to use in there, and I had you speaking in my class, and we show this drawing, and that you're not approving of them, but you're showing them these words are out there. Well, that in itself is now a high crime, you know, quickly get you fired. So, but why are these words so important to you that you intrude them into your cartoons quite deliberately?
Because I think that it's very important to delegitimize concepts of obscenity if they are abstractions. And also, if when it comes to some of the cartoons that I do, there's one in the book, actually, that addresses this problem quite accurately, I think. And what it is, it's an artist who is standing with his cartooning pad, and he's looking at a politician, and the politician is screaming these racial epithets and just being very ugly, his arms out screaming to the world. And the artist is drawing accurately the guy, the politician is doing it, and putting the exact words that the politician is using. Second frame, he's carrying it with a big smile on his face to bring it to his editor at the magazine where he works. And the editor is actually saying, we'll only publish it if you let us take out all the dirty language.
Yeah.
And so that's where I feel that's where the problem is, because the artists, many times, what makes them their work so powerful is just the fact that they're reporting on the truth blatantly without any filters or any censorship.
You know, I think that's really important. And I just taught a class on the whole homosexual revolution and the success and so forth. And there's a very emotional moment for me, because one of my childhood friends was routinely referred to by Unkind, which is almost all of the children in the neighborhood, as Mel the, you know, F-A-G. Okay.
Right.
And you cut out that word, you cut out the experience. This kid was tormented almost every day of his life. Somebody yelled at him. Somebody dismissed him. Somebody demeaned him. You know, and then he ended up committing suicide, jumping out of his mother, you know, his apartment. You know, when he was, I don't know, 21 or something. He never overcame that. You know, and so you can't educate about what the treatment of homosexuals in America or the world was like without showing this bite. And that is true of racial epithets, religious epithets, and so forth. Right. And when we clean it up, and I, you know, it's not a battle I'm particularly willing to have because, you know, you lose. Everybody wants it cleaned up. But they don't solve the problem by cleaning it up because they erase the hate there, you know. And not to trivialize it, but that's what's descriptive. And you know, you got me into a little bit of trouble over this because it's in the movie. What is the title of the movie? We got to get people to watch this movie.
Sure. It's Mr. Fish Cartooning from the Deep End.
Yeah. And it's hard to get, but it's out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they go to SharePost, they can find a reference to it, but yeah, elsewhere, you know, but, and what's his name? The filmmaker. He's very good.
Pablo Bryant.
Yeah. And so people should check that out if they want more of Mr. Fish, which they should want more. But I think this is a good point on which to end. I was hoping we would get it down the frame of time, but I think it's important to pursue this a little bit. You know, you don't make people comfortable, but then again, not Mort Sahl and Lenny Bruce, and at the end of his life, John Lennon didn't make people comfortable, you know. And what we teach people now is, yeah, be interesting, you know, think differently, outside the box, but don't do it in such a way as you crush the box, you know. Careerism, the meritocracy requires an allegiance to certain form. And not being too disturbing and being persistent. I remember you have me dealing with the Wenho Li case, this Chinese scientist, and that wasn't, say, Chinese, he was actually from Taiwan, but was accused by the New York Times of stealing the most precious secrets, and they had him locked up for 9 months and, you know, surveilled by camera. You describe all that in the book, you know, I think. And I remember in that, as a journalist, if I wrote about it a couple of times, that was okay. Interesting, Bob. Yeah, you make some good points. When I was persistent and wrote 20 columns on it, I remember they say, you got to drop it. I remember at the LA Times being told, you got to drop it. You know, it's enough. People think you're carrying a cross. But I said, did they release him? Did I miss something? Is he not in solitary? You know, is he getting a new hearing? What? How could I drop it? You know, and that idea that you don't drop it. You know, I've asked you to drop things as your publisher at times. Come on, give it a rest. That's the words they used with me. That's what publishers and people will always do, give it a rest. But no, the society hasn't given it a rest. There will be that move now. Black Lives Matter, give it a rest, you know. Why? Are there not the disproportionate number of black people in our prison system, or unemployed, et cetera, et cetera? Is discrimination dead? Give it a rest. And that has really been the challenge you have faced, and that's what your book is really about, and the people that you interviewed or profiled in your book. And so at some point, will careerism trump everything? Or will you break that and not give it a rest? And, you know, you've got two daughters now about to, what, go to college?
Yeah.
And, you know, and life has not been easy for you, and you have a great wife who trained in journalism and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I know, you know, not just the pandemic, but in general, it's not easy being, what does it mean to be a cartoonist, an artist at this time in America? There's no space for you, is there?
No, but at least I get the joy of feeling like I have some integrity. And engaging with people from the past in this book is my attempt to link that all up and say, look, there is virtue in just, you know, having a white knuckled grip on your own soul. That's meaningful to me.
Most of them let go of that grip at some point, but then try to get it back.
Right.
The book has a lot of successful people in it.
Yeah.
You know, Joan Baez is a very good example. She clearly was, you know, the top of different charts and great career. On the other hand, clearly a human being who has struggled with, you know, what does it all mean and how do you push it and so forth. That's what makes all of the people, again, the book is Nobody Left. Come on, you know, Conversations with Famous Radicals, Progressive and Culture. But what's interesting about it is all of them, you know, wanted to get back. In Graham Nash, you have him finding it an abstract painting or painting later in life in your vignette. Yep. About him. But there's, you know, at the end of the day, integrity, it's what you hold on to. But it's easy to say, hard to do, isn't it, Dwayne, Mr. Fish?
Exactly true, yeah.
Isn't it? It's
tough, but the rewards are vast, you know. It's again, it's just having a meaningful life is the best.
So that's a reason to buy this book. Let's close on that, you know, get it under 50 minutes. Nobody left. Give it to your nephew or your own child or grandchild, and that will give them a reason to hold on to integrity. Careerism isn't everything. And on that note, Dwayne Booth, Mr. Fish, I just want to encourage people one way or another to get in touch. I'm sure you, plenty of people listening to this already know your work, but watch the film. Go. We have a fish tank at Sharepost, which is a good. You have, what is it, Clown Crack?
Yep, clowncrack.com. Yep,
that's yeah, my site. Clown Crack. Okay, that's it, Fish, Mr. Fish. I want to thank Christopher Ho at KCRW for week after week getting this show posted. And I want to thank Natasha Hakimi-Zapata, for a good friend of yours, for writing the intro. Hopefully she'll be kind to you on this one. Lucy Berbio for doing the transcription, who, again, somebody who knows you well. And I want to thank, most of all, Joshua Shear, our executive producer, who's a big fan of yours. So this will be one interview where he doesn't try to cut some of my darlings, and he'll say, I should have probably gone longer. And I want to thank the JWK Foundation in memory of another contrarian, and I use that in the best sense, Gene Stein, well-known for Edie and West of Eden and other books, a great interviewer in her own right, the interviewer of Faulkner in his heyday and Paris Review and what have you. And somehow I think of you too in a similar vein. Did you know Gene Stein?
I've met her a couple times, yeah.
And were you impressed?
I was. She was very charming.
On that note, it's really been delightful to talk to you. And I'll be back next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence.
J'ai allumé le feu, mes chagrins, mes plaisirs, je n'ai plus besoin d'eux. Balayer les amours avec leurs trémolos, balayer pour toujours.